Exodus chapter 2, verses 1 through 10, the title of the message this morning is Mom, the Woman Who Changes the World. She really does. You know, we've all seen those movies, the scenario where something delicate or something vulnerable is repeatedly threatened along its way from point A to point B. Something like the waiter who narrowly avoids the swinging doors and the angry waitresses, the clueless patrons or the running children as he seeks to deliver platters that are filling both hands and he's weaving his way in and out of the crowds. Sometimes this can be done rather creatively, like with the children's Christmas movie, The Polar Express, where the ticket flies out the window and you see it transformed along the way and you follow it till it finds its way back into the boy's hand. Sometimes it's a little more slapstick. You can think of some of the scenarios with maybe a Dick Van Dyke or a Don Knotts as they're bumbling around with a bucket stuck on their head and they're taking different steps and they're avoiding this mishap and that threat and they find their way safely through these impossible scenarios. The book of Genesis has been for us, it's followed something of this kind of an incredible plot line where a fledgling nation, vulnerable to say the least, is providentially shepherded through one incredible threat after another, only to be menaced yet again by another seemingly insurmountable, impossible threat. In today's passage, as we look at it, we come across another story that's a bit unbelievable in the way that God orchestrates all of the events in passing this vulnerable child from arm to waiting arm, avoiding the edict of a Pharaoh, the mouth of the Nile, the allurement ultimately of the comfort, power, and prestige of a palace, as this child goes on his way to leading God's people out of a centuries-long bondage in Egypt. As we look at the life of Moses, this hero of the Hebrews would reach a status second only to the nation's founder, Abraham. Everybody within the nation of Israel would know who Moses was. His role in history would alter the course of events forever, temporarily sinking the reigning superpower of the day into oblivion, establishing a nation at the center of world politics, even today, as you listen to the news. His legacy would affect jurisprudence for millennia. What I want us to note this morning is the quiet, though not insignificant, role of this hero's mother, a woman who in effect is responsible for changing the world. No great accomplishments are listed for us in Scripture of this formidable heroine. Incredibly, in this only story that records any of her earthly activity, she remains unnamed other than the child's mother. Yet as the mother of Moses, a divine lawgiver, a heroic statesman, a fearless leader, Jochebed rises up today some 35 centuries later as an immortal heroine of Scripture. As we come to this passage, I think we can say with some certainty that, Mom, your mission, should you choose to accept it, is to change the world. That's all. That's what you've been commissioned with as a godly mother. And as we look at this text, I think we'll find that there's really two ways in which moms change the world. They've changed your world. I know my mom's changed my world. I know my wife is changing the world for my own young people. How do moms do it? How do moms do it? There's two ways in which mothers change the world. The first is this, that mothers change the world by forging genuine faith in desperate times. Verses 1 through 4, we read what this looks like. Motherhood is in Jochebed. She's preserving life in an arena that's threatened by death. At this point, she remains an unnamed mother. Her story is, it's not significant, and yet it's hugely significant. She stands out because she doesn't stand out. In this story, only Moses is really named, and that in verse 10 throughout this story. We don't know the name of the Pharaoh. We don't know the name of the Pharaoh's daughter. We don't know at this point the name of Moses' sister. And we don't find out till later what the name of Moses' mother is, Jacob. Only Moses is named within this narrative that we have in these short 10 verses. And this is the only time that we see Jochebed active in the story of Scripture at all. But we see that both Moses and his mother stand as representatives of something larger than themselves, because what was happening for Moses was about to happen for the entire nation of Israel. He was drawn out. He was taken out of that which was threatening to him, and God was about to draw his people out of bondage to serve him. But Jochebed, a mother, her story is rather uninteresting as it lays out for us. Read again verse 1. Now a man from the house of Levi went and took as his wife a Levite woman, and the woman conceived and bore a son. This is just what happens. A lady gets married, she gets pregnant, she has a baby. It could be anyone within the society. He limits it to a certain tribe, a tribe that doesn't necessarily stand out within the blessings that we've just looked at back in Genesis chapter 49. Levi was one, in fact, that was going to be dispersed throughout the nation. So here's a no-name woman from a tribe that isn't that significant at this point, and going through the ordinary stuff of marriage, childbirth, of becoming a mother. Extraordinary? Absolutely. Raising a child is one of the most extraordinary things that can ever happen to an individual. It's always by faith. It's always bigger than what you can handle. You were bigger than your mother could handle, no matter how angelic you delude yourself into being. Motherhood requires faith, because motherhood requires grace. And yet, it's an ordinary feature of life. The extraordinary thing about this woman is that she lived a life of faith. Keep your fingers here in Exodus 2. We're coming right back to it. But go to Hebrews chapter 11 for a second. Hebrews chapter 11. Verse 23. We're familiar with this passage as the hall of faith. It says in verse 23, by faith, Moses, when he was born, was hidden for 3 months by his parents, because they saw that the child was beautiful. They were not afraid of the king's edict. In God's economy, he sees fit to highlight this one woman who, at this point in the story, remains unnamed. She's unnamed in the Hall of Faith. We find out later in the book of Exodus, her name is Jochebed. But God doesn't even see fit in chapter 11 of the book of Hebrews to write her name down. He just writes down that she was a woman of faith, and her primary role was functioning as a mother. How heroic is that? Absolutely heroic, as it turns out. Because God sets her aside. God showcases this woman for her extraordinary faith. So at this point, she remains unnamed, but at this point, times are particularly desperate. Go back to chapter 1 in the book of Exodus. Verse 8. There arose a new king over Egypt who didn't know Joseph, and he said to his people, behold, the people of Israel are too many. They're too mighty for us. Come, let's deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply. Verse 11, so he says, they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with heavy burdens. They built for Pharaoh store cities, Pithom and Ramses. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied, the more they spread abroad. The Egyptians were in dread of the people of Israel. So they ruthlessly made the people of Israel to work as slaves and made their lives bitter with hard service and mortar and brick and all kinds of work in the field. And all their work, they ruthlessly made them to work as slaves. When Jochebed comes onto the scene. Israel's been in bondage. Israel's been down in Egypt for centuries. But Israel's now at this point that they're in bondage. We don't know how long, where within this sequence of events they entered into bondage. We just know that as Jochebed comes to that prime age of young teen, early adulthood, she finds herself at that delicate age where she's ready to begin a family of her own. And she sets her sights on the future. And she's raising her children in slavery. Programmatic, systematic bondage. Beating, whips. There are a couple different times it's used the word ruthless. So she's furnishing more chattel for Pharaoh by providing children for him to beat, to use, to abuse. I don't know if you ever get scared as you look at where our nation is going, at what's happening with our economy, at what's happening with our morals in our nation, what's happening with our politics. It's scary. It's absolutely frightening to think about not just what I have to raise my children in, but what my children are going to have to raise their children in. Jochebed is raising her children in a society that is systematically and programmatically engaged in subduing them, in subjecting them, in humiliating them. But that's not enough. Verses 14 through 16 of chapter 1 says that there's private intimidation and manipulation. Behind the scenes, Pharaoh is acting as politicians often do. He calls in two midwives. He sets them down before him and says, "Now listen, here's the problem. You're going to help me. If you value your life, you're going to help me." And they say, "Let's see about that." And so he lays out the plan. He says, "You're going to kill the boy babies, and you're going to help me with this." They don't end up doing it because they fear the Lord and God blesses them for it. So Pharaoh finds out things aren't working the way he's been trying to manipulate and pull strings and intimidate. And so he comes later on in verse 22, and he has a solution that he's going to address this publicly. And so it says in verse 22, Pharaoh commanded all his people, "Every son that's born of the Hebrews you shall cast into the Nile, but you shall let every daughter live." He tries to privately manipulate, murder these children, and now he tries to work up the public. He goes into all of his media fanfare, and he says, "Folks, we've got a problem right here in River City, with a capital T, and that rhymes with P, and that stands with, no, I, it's the Israelites, H, it's the Hebrews. We've got a problem, and we've got to wipe them out." And people are going, "Oh, we got trouble, 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 trouble." He says, "That's right, so here's what I want you to do. I need your help. I want you to take those children and throw them in the Nile." "Oh, we got trouble." Throw him, and he gets them all worked up into a fever. And they're a part of his program, not just of murder, but of genocide. This is the context that Jochebed births Moses into. Are you starting to feel a little bit of the tension of being a mom in that day? This is the era. This is the context in which Jochebed becomes a mom. And usually as you get the baby's born and all of a sudden the birth announcements go out, a baby boy. If it's a boy, you didn't say anything. Because a baby boy meant he was taking a deep swim in the Nile, never to surface. This is the context in which Jochebed exercises her faith. She's in this context, when Pharaoh says to throw them into the Nile, Pharaoh is actually seeking a divine intervention of the gods, if you will. The Nile River was one of the supreme gods within Egypt. And he delivers these Hebrew babies to the judgment of the Nile god. It's in this context where this mother preserves life in the context of death. She's learning to forge genuine faith Her faith is starting to look like something, and it's going to require a choice. Am I going to fear man, or am I going to fear God? This is apostolic in its flavor. As Jesus Christ leaves, and in Acts chapter 4, Acts chapter 5, where the apostles stand before the Sanhedrin, they've just been whipped, they've been brought into the Sanhedrin, and they say, "Now you will not speak in the name of Jesus." Peter answers and says, "You decide. Should we listen to man or should we listen to God?" That's the kind of faith that Hebrews says Jochebed exhibits at this moment. She didn't fear the king. The one she did fear was God. And there was no way on God's green earth she was going to give up her baby for the order of a king. As verse 2 comes, they won't all go this slow, I promise. Verse 2, the woman conceived and bore a son, and she saw that he was a fine child, so she hid him for 3 months. Mothers see beyond what's visible. Mother, as you look at this, every mother is proud of that little bundle of joy that they bring into the world. They're all little fat, squishy red faces. They all look ugly. But they're so proud of this little thing that comes up. They're holding this thing. Oh, he's so ugly. He's not cute. Here's this baby. She looks at this baby. Oh, isn't he fine? The word there is tov. It's good. But I think it's significant that two other times in Scripture it repeats this fact. Moses was a lovely child. Moses was a beautiful child. In Acts chapter 7, as Stephen is recounting the history of Israel, it says, the child was beautiful to God. And Hebrews 11 talks again about the child was beautiful. He was a fine child. We don't know if it's talking about the features. He was a fine-featured child. He was one who could stand his place in court before the Pharaohs. It's kind of the word that's used in both the New Testament passages. But the idea is this, at least. What Jochebed sees when she looks down into this tiny little baby is she sees something more than just the physical. She looks down on this weak, helpless, cute, ugly little child and says, "You're precious, and you're not just precious to me. You're precious to God. God has a plan for you, my son." And because she believed that this child was beautiful, not just in a mother's eyes, but in the eyes of the God who created this child, she was willing to hide him for 3 months. Mom, you understand, don't you, that you do have the power of life and death in your hands as you work and manipulate, not manipulate, as you forge the heart of that child in your home. As you look into their eyes and you say, my beautiful child, I love you so much. You're so precious, but you're not just precious to me. You're precious to the one who made you. And God has a special plan for your life. Where are they going to hear that? From their public school teacher? You're an accident and you came from a frog. They can hear that from their brothers, okay? No. They're going to hear that from their boss? They're going to hear that from their schoolmates? Mom, they have to hear it from you. And if you don't take the time to remind your child of God's special purpose for them as a child, where will they hear it if they don't hear it from mom? No wonder moms play such an important role. It's more than just motherly pride. It's believing that this child is not just beautiful in my sight, but in the sight of the God who formed him in the womb. And that's the reason that Hebrews says she hid him for 3 months. Mom is forging a genuine faith in times that are working against mom. That she believes there's a God. She believes that there's a purpose. She believes that there's more to life than the pain, the suffering, the ugliness, and the persecution of right now. There is hope. And mom, it's your job to provide it. But you can't provide it if you don't have it. And so her faith is forged in a desperate time. But mothers, secondly, change the world by manifesting this faith in difficult ways. And so we see in verses 3 through 10 what these ways look like. First, she delivers her son to the unstable power of nature. It says in verse 3 that when she could hide him no longer, she took him for him a basket made of bulrushes and daubed it with bitumen and pitch. And she put the child in it and placed it among the reeds by the river bank. She takes that child and she delivers him to the river. She doesn't throw him in. The word that's used in Acts chapter 7 is exposing the child. It's kind of like what the Romans would do. They'd take the child and just put it out on a hillside, expose it to the elements, expose it to the wild beasts. If you didn't want the child, you exposed it. And whatever will be, and it usually ends up dead. She exposed her son by taking him to the river, and it's very much in line with what the Pharaoh had commanded, but she puts him in these waters that are meant to destroy him, and she builds an ark. She does some preparation. There's a very deliberate vehicle. It says in verse 3, she took a basket that's woven out of these crisp, sharp, strong leaves of the bulrushes made in the water, for the water, and she pats it on both sides with this bitumen, this pitch, this oily substance that wouldn't allow the water to seep through. She made a waterproof basket. The word basket there that's used is a special word that we've seen in Genesis chapter 6, verse 14. It's the word translated there as ark. She took a little ark. Now, the interesting thing about this is the only two places that this word is used in the whole Hebrew Old Testament. Noah, in the ark, rose above the waters that brought destruction to the rest of humanity. Moses, in an ark, rose above the waters to which he had been destined for destruction. But God provides salvation in an ark, redemption. We see that there's a certain place to which she takes him, among the reeds by the riverbank. In verse 5 it says, "And the daughter of Pharaoh came to bathe," right by those reeds at the riverbank. As mom says, okay, I can no longer protect this child of mine. I'm going to have to turn him over. I'm going to have to set him loose. The problem is too big, and she takes him and releases him to the powers of nature. You think of that river, the Nile. What floats in the river has big long tail, has big ugly teeth? There's crocodiles. In fact, they worshipped them as gods of the river. There's crocodiles. There's currents. And this river runs right through the middle of Egypt, where on either bank there's Egyptians that Pharaoh had said, if you find a Hebrew baby boy, you must throw him in the river. Not in a basket, not in an ark. Throw him in the river. Let's see if the river gods take care of these children. There's all sorts of dangers. And as she takes, you would think that there's got to be some other way. But she takes this child and she delivers it to the place of certain destruction, but not without taking precautions. And so she brings it to this certain place, and then she leaves in verse 4 an innocent witness. It says, verse 4, his sister stood at a distance to know what would be done to him. Now, this is still a girl who's in Jochebed's home. She's older than Moses. She's watching out for Moses. Jochebed leaves her there because as Pharaoh's daughter comes down to the riverside, it would be more natural to see this child interacting, playing, than to see somebody who's supposed to be working, meandering, loitering down by the waterside. She leaves this child to watch what's going to happen. Now, I don't know what kind of a mom you are, but if I were a mom, and I'm not, but if I were, I can guarantee If I put my baby boy in a basket in the river filled with crocodiles, I wouldn't want my other children to watch what might happen. You know what I'm saying? So we probably have a pretty good guess that she doesn't think he's going to be swallowed up by the crocodiles. She has a pretty good guess that something's going to happen, and whatever's going to happen is going to be safe for the child's eyes to behold. And so as she leaves Miriam in her appointed task of watching, she says, "Tell me what happens to my boy. Something's got to happen. I don't know what it's going to be. I have my hopes, but something's got to happen." So she leaves him there. We see that she delivers her son then to the pagan influence of society. She knew where the Pharaoh's daughter comes to bathe, and eventually she does. We see there in verse 5, "Now the daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the river, while her young women walked beside the river. She saw the basket among the reeds and sent her servant woman, and she took it." Now verse 6, "When she opened it, she saw the child, and behold, the baby was crying." The tension is beginning to rack up here in the narrative. It's starting to build. The heart is supposed to be pounding just a little bit more. Ba-boom, 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 ba-boom. She sees it. She grabs it. She opens it. And is she going to take it out and throw it in the river? So she has pity on it. This pagan woman growing up in the household of the Pharaoh who said to destroy it. And she knows exactly what she's going to do. She knows exactly what she's doing. At the end of verse 6, she says, "This is one of the Hebrew children." And in the middle of that, it says, "And she took pity on him." Can you imagine a mom not just turning over her baby to the river, with the Egyptians on either side, the crocodiles, the currents, and everything that can go bad? What if she didn't get one part waterproof? All of a sudden, that little baby starts going down with the ship. Not just turning over my baby to nature. Turning over my baby to that society which is adamantly opposed, programmatically opposed, systematically opposed, spiritually opposed to the existence, to the success of my child. What a scary thing. And she entrusts her child first to the physical fate of Pharaoh's daughter. Secondly, his spiritual state. Verse 10. "So when the child grew up, she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and Moses became Pharaoh's daughter's son." That just blows my mind. What's she going to do with his life? Oh, thank God she spared it. Now what's she going to do with his life? That little heart, that tender spirit. "Thank you, but no thank you. You're not going to touch my child. You're not going to infect my child. You're not going to teach my child. I'm going to take care of that." She releases her child to the pagan influences as she hands him over to Pharaoh's daughter. Spiritually, physically. But we see in the middle of this story that as Jochebed plays her role in the story of redemption at this recorded time, this desperate time in the nation's history, that she wasn't really turning over her son to the powers of nature. She wasn't even really turning over her son to the influences of a pagan society. What she was doing that moment when she placed that basket in the water and pushed it away from herself and walked away was entrusting that child to the providence of God. A God that at present was allowing them to go through difficulties that were hard to put into words, difficulties that she'd spent nights crying over, difficulties that she'd spent nights losing sleep over as she held a child and muffled its cry in the dark. A God that had promised at one point that he would visit his people, that he would provide salvation for his people. And she didn't know how, she didn't know when, she didn't know where, but she believed that God was going to work, and she wanted this child to be a part of it. And she believed that he would. And as she pushes him out in that little ark on the bosom of the deep that threatened to swallow up his very life, she entrusts him to the hand of a faithful Creator, of a faithful Redeemer. The whole point of this story is the presence of God. But just like Moses' mother, God isn't once named in this story. But the whole point is God's present. From the child that's born, being able to hide him for 3 months without being caught, a basket that floats and doesn't submerge on the river, that's found by Pharaoh's daughter, that's wanted by Pharaoh's daughter, that ironically the child's mother gets to raise. And this is really the real work of Jochebed in the story. We're told more about her building the ark and setting it out in the deep and so on. But the real work of this mother took place in verse 8. Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Go." So the girl went and called the child's mother, and Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this child away and nurse him for me." The word literally means just to breastfeed him. "And I will give him your wages." So the woman took the child and nursed him. And verse 10, when he grew up, she brought him to Pharaoh. How long was that? We don't know. The word has the idea of gaining some maturity, not brought to adulthood. Like verse 11, when Moses had grown up, that is, he came into adulthood. But here he's growing up. He's probably past the age where he's weaned. He's probably able to be instructed at this point. Instructed in what? The stage is set in these tender years that will carry him through adulthood, that will shape his mind, his perspective of his adult life. She shaped him to understand that there was a God by whom he was protected. "Moses, let me tell you your story." She pulls out the old family photo book. "Moses, go get me your baby book. I've got a story to tell you again." "Moses, this is your story. When you were born, there was an edict that said all boys must be killed. You were supposed to be dead, Moses. But we hid you for 3 months, and then you were supposed to be thrown in the Nile. We put you in the Nile that was supposed to swallow you up. And God kept your little ark afloat until Pharaoh's daughter came down. Moses, I was given instructions by Pharaoh's daughter to keep you alive. God saved your life. Perhaps, we don't know, but perhaps she used the language of Jacob as he's departing in the land of Egypt. He says, boys, I'm turning you over to the hands of the God who's redeemed me from every evil." The first time we have redemption mentioned is back in chapter 48, verse 16, where Israel says, he's the God who's redeemed me from every evil. The idea is to be, God has taken ownership. God has reclaimed my life in every evil thing that the persecutor has brought into my life. God has redeemed me. He's claimed ownership in my life and said, "Oh, no, you don't. You won't touch my anointed one." Moses, that's the God. That's your God. He's redeemed you out of your troubles. She also painted a picture for him that helped him to recognize that there was a people to whom he belonged. You saw it up in verse 22, chapter 1. Pharaoh's commanding his people to be against these people. In verse 11, Moses goes out when he'd grown up, and he went out to his people, and he saw the Egyptian beating a Hebrew who was one of his people. We've got two different people groups. Moses, we're in the middle of Egypt, and you don't belong to that people. You belong to this people. And by the time he was, we don't know how old, but young, but old enough to understand, old enough to get it in his head, he knew that he was different, that he was on his way to a different place because he belonged to a different group of people, that he didn't belong right here, though he was here right now, in the world, but not of the world. We see in Moses' life played out for us what's given in principle in Proverbs chapter 22, verse 6. Train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. We've seen other examples of this over the course of history. John Newton, who's called the old blasphemer because he was with his father on a ship, a captain of a ship. He finally became a captain of his own ship in the disgusting politics of slave trade. Cursing God, living like a slave. In fact, eventually his men mutinied and tied him up and sold him off into slavery himself. Newton later referred to himself as the old blasphemer. But Newton was raised by a godly mother until the age of 7, before he went on the high seas with his father. And daily his mother would pray for him. Daily his mother would tell him the stories of Jesus and of a God who loved him and sent his son to redeem him. And when he was old and when he went through the storm and the person next to him was washed overboard in the middle of the night, he got down on his knees and he cried out, my God, save me. And he did. Because a godly woman who pointed a child in the right direction when he was old, he followed in that footstep that his mother had painted for him. She provided a picture of what he was about to do for all his people. God was in charge of this giving over of this child. And God was going to use the life of Moses to draw a picture for what he was about to do for all of his people. In verse 10 it says, when Pharaoh's daughter took Moses, she named him Moses for this reason. She drew him out of the water. The word Moses has both a kind of a double etymology. It fits into the Hebrew. It also fits into the Egyptian language of the day. You've heard of Thutmos, or the king, Ramses, Mises, Moses, Thutmos, has the idea of son. Also then in the Hebrew, it has the idea of being drawn out. And the word here is, I have drawn out my son. And what, without even knowing it, Pharaoh's daughter names Moses and gives him uses him as a picture of what God's about to do for the entire nation of Israel. This idea of redemption is going to be big. As God lays claim to his son, his child, and brings him up out of Egypt, he's going to redeem him. He's going to claim him back as his own. It's going to come at a price. It's going to come at the price of a spotless lamb. But this redemption then that's highlighted for us, it's only spoken of twice. Once as a future in chapter 6, verse 6, and second as something that's already passed in chapter 15 as they celebrate coming through the waters of death and destruction as they close in on Egyptian Pharaoh and his armies. God redeems his people, and this becomes the paradigm. This becomes the picture. This becomes the model for what redemption looks like from this point forward. And Moses becomes the redeemer of his people, a man who stands between God and the people, a son. Moses is going to picture Jesus Christ. As you look at the role of this mother, it makes you kind of wonder what other mothers have impacted history. Where would the world be today if it wasn't for Susanna Wesley, mother of John and Charles Wesley, who influenced the entire British Empire with spiritual revival? Where would the world be without Mary Ball Washington, whose son became the father of this nation? Where would the world be without a John Newton's unnamed mother, who gets saved and teams up with William Wilberforce to rid the British Empire of slave trade? Where would the world be without a Nancy Lincoln, mother of Abraham Lincoln, who won the fight against slavery in this country and preserved our nation in a desperate time? Where would the world be without a young girl named Mary, who said, be it unto me as you see fit. I'm the handmaid of the Lord. exercise faith in some desperate times. Mom, your mission, should you choose to accept it, is to change the world. One precious life at a time. That's a mission. That's a high calling. And I hope, guys, that we never underestimate what God has called and equipped our wives to do. They're doing a job that, frankly, He didn't think we could. And so He entrusted it to mothers. Praise the Lord. He's working redemption through mothers, one precious life at a time.